Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. I'm joined by Chad Bird. Chad, what's going on?
Hey, man. How are you?
I'm good, dude.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about you soaking in the sun in California.
Hey.
But now you're back in chilly Arkansas.
It is chilly here. You know, I mean, I live in the South, but we're in what is known in Arkansas as the just kidding spring. So it got warm.
Fakes you out.
Yeah, so everyone gets excited. I know better. I've lived here long enough. You have a week where it gets up in the 70s, and everyone's like, here it is.
Yeah,
and I'm like, don't worry, guys. We're gonna have 2 weeks of cold still, until it gets warm and then cold, and then warm again. That's second spring is the one you're looking for. That's the one.
Yeah. Fun.
Yeah, so I had to leave. As soon as it got cold again, I said I gotta go to California.
Yeah, nice, yeah. Nice.
But I didn't stay there long enough apparently because it's still cold here.
Had to camp out there a few more weeks.
Yeah, I guess so. So what's going on with you?
Oh, not much. I turned in about an 8-month project the other day. I turned in my next book with Baker. It's called Upside Down Spirituality, The 9 Essential Failures of a Faithful Life.
There you go.
So that is in the works. If you've ever been involved anyway with book production or know someone who has it, it's just because you turn in a manuscript doesn't mean it's going to be on the shelves next week. It's a long process, but it's good to at least have that much behind me. So we'll do all the editing and all that kind of back and forth stuff. So maybe sometime early next year,
awesome.
That'll be out. So yeah, I've been working on that and just living the life.
Living the life. Hey, you know, if people don't want to wait that long, there's a book coming out May 19th. There's a book scheduled for release that me and you both contributed to. That is in the Old Testament.
Yeah, right.
That's right. The Sinner Saint Devotional 60 Days in the Psalms. We're publishing our first ever devotional book with 1517, and me and Chad both wrote for it, and Eric Sorensen from 30 Minutes wrote for it, along with Elise Fitzpatrick and Jared Wilson and Stephen Paulson and a whole bunch of other people. There's like 11 of us, and we wrote these devotionals on the Psalms, and that is coming out next month.
So, yeah, I'm pumped to get that in folks' hands. That'd be a good resource.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a lot of different voices and a lot of different styles, but it's very, very Christ saturated. It's funny. I did. You know, you write a devotional on the Psalms. I had to serve as the general editor for it, and so I did this thing where I figured out what word is the most common word in when you take the entire document. So when you take the whole manuscript and you figure out what word is used the most here, you know, with the exception of the or something like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
But the most common word that use that is not a word that joins other words together is Jesus.
That's fantastic.
So I was pleased with that. The word Jesus is used more than the word Psalm.
And quite rightly, right?
There you go.
Yeah, he is the key of David, right? If you don't have Jesus there, then you can't unlock the Psalms.
That's right. So that's how I knew it was good.
Yeah, that is a very good sign right there. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Yep. So you should. We'll be tweeting and Facebooking stuff out. It's not quite available for pre-order yet. That'll be soon. But that the release date on that is May 19th. Sinner Saint Devotional. Hopefully, all you guys will pick up a copy of that and it'll serve you well. Chad, where are we at in Leviticus?
Well, speaking of sinners and saints, we're going to hear about some sinners and saints this morning. We've got some good stuff coming up here. We are in Leviticus 9, and we're probably going to bridge over to 10 as well. So we got a couple chapters to look at today. So that's where we are. I was trying to think of a good way to kind of sum up the message of Leviticus 9 and 10. It's sort of one of these good church, bad church kind of sections, or good worship, bad worship, kind of dual chapters. But if there's a single theme that runs through these two chapters, it's really the idea of the place of fire. I mean, if I had to choose like one image, it'd either be fire or altar, but I think I have to go with fire, and you'll figure that out, especially when we get to Leviticus 10, because we have fire acting in a rather negative way there. So what we're looking at in Leviticus 9, just to kind of give you the bird's eye view here, no pun intended. Chapter 9 is all about the what you might call the inauguration of Israel's worship. So getting everything started, and it's going to break it down into the sacrifices offered, and then it comes to this crescendo with Aaron blessing the people, and then God revealing his glory by fire coming forth from the tabernacle and consuming all of the sacrifices on the altar. So that's kind of a quick run through the chapter. Chapter 10 immediately starts with fire coming forth from God again, except this time it's not coming forth to consume sacrifices on the altar. It's coming forth to actually consume two priests, Nadab and Abihu, who offered strange fire before the Lord. And then after that deadly incident with fire, after that that negative worship experience, if you want to call it that, then there's a discussion of really the duties of the priesthood, what they are to do and what they are not to do. And we have this really important verse about that sums up very succinctly the duties of the priesthood, about distinguishing between the common and the holy, and between the clean and the unclean. So we'll get to that and spend some time talking about that. So that's a quick run through about the two chapters together. So let's back up and talk a little bit more about chapter 9. Now, if you remember from the last episode, and these kind of all join together, in the last episode, we talked about Leviticus 8, a little bit about chapter 7, but mainly about chapter 8. And this is all about the ordination of the priests. So we have everything broken down here into the sacrifices which are offered, the vestments that are placed upon the priest, some of their duties, and all that kind of stuff. And as we heard, this is a rather lengthy process. This took 7 days. So for 7 days, Aaron and his sons went through these sacrifices and washings and vesting and everything that was supposed to take place to bring them into the holy priesthood. So for 7 days, all of this transpired with Aaron and his four sons who were becoming priests with him. So that takes us to the end of chapter 8. Now, chapter 9 begins this way. It says, "Now it came about on the eighth day Moses called Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel, and he said," and he goes on to give them some regulations about the sacrifices. Now, the first thing I want to point out is something that we talked about at least a couple of times, but I think it was in Genesis. It was way back, and that is this idea of the eighth day. Just want to say a little bit of a reminder about that. If you've slept a few times since you listened to those episodes, then maybe this will jog your memory. In the scriptures, when you hear about the eighth day, it's almost without exception in reference to the genesis of kind of a new era, the genesis of a new status, the genesis of a new creation. The eighth day seems to be symbolic of a brand new start that is inaugurated by God in order to place a person into some sort of new position, a new beginning, something like that. So for instance, the male Israelite children were circumcised on the eighth day. Later in Leviticus, we're going to hear about the cleansing of people with a some sort of skin disease. It's usually translated leprosy. It's not actually leprosy, but some sort of skin disease. So they went through a process of cleansing. And then on the eighth day, you had this final cleansing act in which they were restored to full membership in the body of Israel. And then this all kind of climaxes in the New Testament with the eighth day par excellence. I mean, the one that really defines for us exactly what the eighth day is, and that is what we just celebrated, actually, and that is the resurrection of our Lord. So the church fathers talked about this over and over and over, the idea of Christ being raised on a Sunday. That would be the eighth day after the week. And this brings in finally the new creation. This brings in the start of a new age of grace and a new covenant, and the work that God is doing in our world through the completed work of his Son. So all that being said, when we have an eighth day here in Leviticus chapter 9, this is really the start of something new for Israel. This is the inauguration of their worship, of their divine service. So we have 7 days of ordination, and then the eighth day we're going to have the actual sacrificial worship service beginning. Now, if you remember back in Exodus 40, that's a closing chapter of Exodus, we had a description of what took place on that day. And the sacrifices were offered, and God's glory was revealed, and it filled the tabernacle so much that Moses could not enter into the tabernacle. So all that took place back in Exodus 40. And what we have here in chapter 9 is a kind of a more breaking down exactly of what happened on that particular day. So you have to read Exodus 40 and Leviticus 9 in tandem to really understand what's going on. So what does go on? Well, most of the chapter is describing the various sacrifices that were offered on that day. These are the ones that we've covered already. You've got sin offerings, you've got burnt offerings, you've got peace offerings, you have meal offerings. Everything is broken down in great detail in the verses 2 through 21, I guess you'd say. And we're not going to spend time going over all those details because we've covered all those sacrifices before. The only point that I want to make about them is basically what happened was there were sacrifices for the priest, and then there were sacrifices for the people of Israel. And these kind of had a two-stage effect, if you will. Some sacrifices, the first sacrifices were offered in order to provide cleansing for the people, to take away their defilement, to remove their sin. And then the second sacrifice that was offered was the peace offering. And so the first sacrifices having cleansed the people, the peace offerings, the second sacrifices, become the means whereby God then works blessing into the life of the Israelites, actually speaks blessings through Aaron into the lives of the Israelites. So you can kind of think of that as really the twofold process that these sacrifices were designed to go through. The sacrifices for sin provided atonement and provided absolution and provided cleansing. And then the peace offerings were the means by which God came to his people in order to fill them with his peace and with his life, with his blessings. So all this took place on this eighth day. And then we come, after all of these sacrifices, we come to really the main point of the chapter in the final three verses. So I'm going to read those to you, and then we'll talk about everything that happens here. So this is Leviticus 9, 22 through 24. This is the way the chapter ends. So all these sacrifices haven't been offered, everything having been done exactly as God commanded, verse 22, then Aaron lifted up his hands toward the people and blessed them. And he stepped down after making the sin offering and the burnt offering and the peace offering. And Moses and Aaron went into the tent of meeting. When they came out and blessed the people, the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. Then fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the portions of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. I bet they did. I know I would have. So what happens here? Okay, so the first part of the chapter says, all right, this is what Aaron did. He did everything just like God had commanded him to do. All the sacrifices were offered. Then after that, we have a twofold blessing that takes place. So first of all, Aaron, he lifts his hands up toward the people, and he speaks God's words of blessing upon them. And this he did from the altar, because he says after that he stepped down after making these offerings. So that's the first blessing that Aaron speaks. Then he and Moses, they go into the tent of meeting, presumably to pray, since that's where prayer would have taken place before the altar of incense. And when they came out, it says they blessed the people. So this is a second blessing that that probably Aaron pronounced upon the people. And then it says, after the blessing, God's glory, which in Hebrew would be the Kavod Yahweh. Kavod is the word for glory. So this glory of God, glory of Yahweh, it appears to all the people right after the blessing is pronounced. And not only does this glory appear, but it manifests itself as fire. So you can, if you kind of picture this in your mind, there's Moses and Aaron. They've just stepped out of the tent of meeting. All the sacrifices are there on the altar. Aaron pronounces a blessing, and then all of a sudden, you have fire that comes from the Holy of Holies through the holy place out of the tent of meeting, and it shoots over to the altar, and it burns all of the sacrifices on the altar. And as the people see it, they shout in fear and in amazement, and they fall on their faces in order to worship Yahweh. So this is a remarkable scene in lots of different ways. I mean, it's a unique scene in that we don't have, this is not like, it wasn't like this occurred every single time that the Israelites gathered at the tent of meeting for one of the services. This is a unique event in that respect. But it's also not unique in another respect. What was really happening here was that God was showing the Israelites that his glory would henceforth be manifested in two different ways. First of all, it would be manifested through the blessing that Aaron would pronounce upon the people. They would, which usually referred to as the Aaronic benediction. We'll get to that in a second. So Aaron would speak these words of blessing over the people. So that'd be one way in which God's glory would be revealed through the speech of Aaron to the people, pronouncing divine words upon them. And then secondly, in a more kind of tangible sort of way, the glory of God, which is seen as fire here, this fiery glory of God would be manifested to the people from this time forth on top of the altar, so that any time that the people saw the altar, saw the fire consuming the sacrifices, they would know that this fire is not just regular fire, but this fire is actually the fiery glory of God that has taken up its residence in the altar and is accepting the sacrifices of the people, consuming the sacrifices of the people, and by that consumption, giving atonement to the people for their sins. So that's the overall message that this one-time event is meant to convey, is that every time that Aaron lifts up his hands, pronounces a blessing, and every time that the people see the fire on the altar consuming the sacrifices, that this is God's way of manifesting his glory, of giving the people cleansing, and of bestowing upon them his blessing and his favor.
There's a lot there.
Yeah, it's packed. This is one of those verses, this collection of verses that you could probably spend a whole sermon series on, because as is very often in Leviticus and elsewhere, sometimes you'll have these key verses in which a whole theology is summarized. Everything you hear from the duty of the priest to the needs of the people, to the way God reveals his glory, to the whole purpose of the altar. I mean, it's like, it's all packed into this one particular incident.
You know what comes to mind when you read a text like that, and I mean, it's pretty, you see the people, you know, fall down, and I mean, this is a pretty extreme thing that you're seeing happen here, right? And mm-hmm. and all the time you hear people say, you know, if God just did something, then, you know, then everyone would just believe, and then everything would be great.
Yeah.
And it shows you the temporary nature of that. I mean, sure. Like, when fire consumes everything on the altar or whatever, like, yeah, I mean, in that moment, I suppose you believe. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an objective evidence right in front of your face that there's definitely something going on. But that's pretty short-lived.
Yeah, especially when we see what happens in the next chapter.
Whenever people say that, and I think this about myself, too, is that if God did something that I would consider supernatural or, you know, that is just out of the ordinary or undeniable, which, of course, Scripture says that the fact that things exist is an undeniable declaration that he is. But, yes. But, you know, something else happening in the midst of things existing, like fire coming down and consuming stuff. Yeah, if you think that that's what would convince you, then you're just wrong. Like, it would convince you for a hot second, but then you find a way to somehow forget it or explain it away or ignore it. And that's, I mean, shoot, we do that with the resurrection. We just celebrated Easter, and you would think the resurrection would be enough, but yeah. No.
Yeah, you know, a faith based almost exclusively in miracles has a pretty brief shelf life.
That's we see that over and over again,
over and over in the scriptures. Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because I've had that same experience. You know, God, just show me a sign, right? You know, or work this miracle, and I'll believe. But that's not the way it is. We see not only in the life of Israel over and over, but it's the same in the ministry of Jesus. I mean, how many miracles did he have to work, and yet still people didn't believe in him. In fact, sometimes when he worked a miracle, the only effect it had was for people to become angry and want to kill him.
I remember in John 6, the beginning of John 6, which comes right on the heels of him feeding the 5,000. And then he has this massive group of people following him, which makes sense. And it's like the next day after feeding 5,000 people with like a Lunchable, where they're like, what sign do you do? Yeah. To prove that you are the Son of God. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, he just did this thing. Like, yeah, so you gonna do any signs? What do you got? What sign do you do that will prove it? Back it up, man.
Yeah.
And that's how it is. We ask for a sign. That's why God does signs. I mean, so far in the Old Testament, we've seen a lot of pretty miraculous things. I mean, the deliverance of, you know, of Israel in general was like just wrought with miraculous intervention. Whether it's the plagues or the Red Sea or whatever it is, but it's not enough. And there's a reason that Jesus says, "Hey, it's an evil and adulterous generation that seeks a sign." It's not that he doesn't do them. He does, but there's something. There's something wrong with us in our sign seeking.
Yeah, it's almost as if miracles do more to prove unbelief than they do belief.
Yes.
You know, when you look at the reactions of people to miracles and the short-lived nature of their faith based upon those, really, it, instead of confirming the faith, it really just kind of brings out our doubt, our inveterate unbelief, our forgetfulness. You know, that we see something and we think it's really awesome and we believe, but the next day, like you say, we're saying, well, we need another sign. Yeah. Show us something else. Impress us again.
Well, you would think, so if you're in this situation, so you put yourself here and you do all these things and the fire is consuming everything. Now you would think that you're in your mind, you would say, or maybe audibly, to your brother. Like, we're dealing with a pretty powerful thing here. We should probably be real careful.
Yeah, you would think so.
We should probably not screw around with this.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd think that that's how that would go. And I know that we think that's what we would do.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably not what we do. Like, a little bit of time goes by, you probably get a little lazy with it.
Mm-hmm.
This is what happens. You sort of get used to the miraculous things of God. You get used to, we're used to the fact that things exist. We're used to creation. We're used to drawing breath, and so we're flipping with those things. And that's exactly what we see happen next, where you would think some, like, people would have, like, fear, with fear and trepidation, they would execute all these things that God has said to execute. But that is not the case.
No, in fact, if you could take out these chapter divisions, we'd see this even more impressively. You just ignore, if you're looking at your Bible now, just ignore that chapter 10 that you have there, and squeeze together 9:24 and 10:1, and you'll see exactly what we're talking about here. So yeah, all this happens, extremely impressive. Something the Israelites have never seen before. Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, Ithamar, all these guys are right there in the thick of things. So, well, what happens? Well, here's what happens. The very next, after they fall on their faces, the very next words are these. Now, Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And what happens? Verse 2. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, "It is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I will be treated as holy. And before all the people, I will be honored." So Aaron, therefore, kept silent. if there is a biblical story which proves what we're talking about the short-lived nature of faith based upon miracles and how quickly we grow accustomed and really hardened to the miraculous that's all around us, it's this story. So what exactly happens here? I mean, what is this strange fire? Well, the first thing that I want to say about this is that if you look at this from one perspective, it doesn't seem like it's that big of a deal. It's not as if Nadab and Abihu committed some terrible, audacious act of sacrilege in the presence of the Lord. It's not like they grabbed a prostitute and took her into the Holy of Holies or something like that. All they did was this. They filled their fire pans with coals. The word fire can also be translated as coals. They filled their fire pans with coals that were not taken from the altar. So this was like common charcoal. All right, this wasn't charcoal. These weren't coals that were taken from the holy place. These were not sacred, holy coals from the altar of the Lord, which is where their fire pans were supposed to be filled from. So they took common fire, and they placed incense on that to burn before the Lord. And as a result of that, instead of just the incense burning, they themselves were burned up. The same verb that's used to describe God's consumption of the burnt offerings, it's literally the verb for eat, akal. So the Lord's fire came out and ate the burnt offerings on the altar. Same thing happened here. It says fire came out from the presence of the Lord and ate them. It consumed them. It did what fire does, right? Fire eats things up. It consumes them. It burns them and reduces them to ashes. And they died before the Lord. So these verses are exactly parallel. Fire comes out in both cases. Something is burned up in both cases, except in one case it's good, and one case it's certainly not good for Nadab and Abihu. So if you just look at it from kind of an ordinary human perspective, it doesn't really seem like Nadab and Abihu have done anything that's that audacious. But if you look at it from the biblical point of view, it's an affront to God in this way. God had very strictly commanded exactly what they were to do. He had told the priest that this is where the fire, the coals, are to be taken from. He had told them that they have to be very careful about distinguishing common from holy, clean from unclean. And Eleazar and Ithamar did not do that. Instead, I don't know where they got, we're not told where they got this fire from, where they got these coals from. Maybe it was from an oven nearby. We really don't know. But they got it somewhere besides the altar. And when they offered the incense on there, that is when the fire came out and consumed them. I have to say, by the way, that I was wrong about this particular section for a long time. I thought that they had offered some sort of wrong incense before God, but that's not really what happened. It doesn't say they offered strange incense before the Lord. It says they offered strange fire, and the word "strange" there really means like illicit, something that's not legalized, not commanded. So this is strange fire or illicit fire before the Lord. So their fire pans would have coals in them. That's what you put coals in there. So the incense, when it's freaking on there, will smoke. And as a result of them using common fire, then they received a very uncommon punishment. Now, the reason this happens, it's sort of one of these, I don't want to call it an object lesson, but it sort of becomes that. Nadab and Abihu, their death is a message, a very stark, no compromise sort of message that God sends, that when he is being dealt with, when he is being approached, especially by his priest, that they are to treat him as he is. That is, they are to treat him as holy. And the way that they treat him as holy, it's real simple. It's nothing complicated. The way they treat God as holy is by doing exactly as he has said. That's the reason there's a great contrast between chapters 9 and 10. So chapter 9 goes into great detail about exactly how all these sacrifices were made just as the Lord commanded. And then fire came out and consumed the sacrifices. Here we have Nadab and Abihu basically kind of coming up with their own way of doing things. In other words, they sort of thought to themselves, you know what? It doesn't really matter where we get our coals from. It doesn't have to be from the altar. We can get it from over here. So we'll do that. We will choose the way that we approach God. We're going to do our own thing. And as a result of that, they met this horrific death. But the message that's being conveyed to Aaron and to his surviving sons, as well as to the priest after them, as well as to us today, is that when we're dealing with the things of God, we don't simply follow whatever we want. We don't simply follow whatever we decide might be the best way to approach God. We don't kind of come up with our own system, our own way of doing things. Instead, we follow what God himself has said. We cling to his word, to the way that he has said he wants us to come to him. And when we do that, we are honoring him, we are treating him as holy, and he is then providing the opportunity to do good to us, to bless us, to give to us the cleansing and the sacrifice that we need. But we don't get to come up with our own way of getting right with God. Instead, we follow what he himself has given to us. We, in other words, hold fast to his word and to his promises and don't concoct something on our own that we think might be a better way of doing that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a confusion of what makes something holy or acceptable. I mean, that so far we've seen tons about where holiness comes from, that God alone makes things holy and acceptable. And when you decide that there's something else apart from what he said is holy and acceptable, is acceptable, or make is holy, that turns out badly. And this goes, this goes for us too. I mean, if we think that we can be, you're supposed to take this from the thing that God said he has made holy, and when you decide you're going to bring something that he hasn't made holy, this turns out badly. So we ourselves know that if we think that we can be acceptable before God any other way than the way that he said we can be acceptable before God, which is him making us holy. So we're holy and acceptable because of our access to holiness, which is Christ. But if you decide you're going to, like, just, you know, grab some holiness that you think looks pretty good, grab some coals that look pretty good, like those ones are burning hot. I'll bring that to God. That's not how this works. What is acceptable to God is what he has said is acceptable, and that's it. And if you do it the other way and decide that you're going to present something that he hasn't said that he has made holy, you get that baptism of fire that John the Baptist talks about, which is, by the way, not a baptism you want.
Yeah, that's the ambiguous nature of fire. Maybe that's not the best word to describe it, but what I mean is that fire is one of these elements that can go either way, right? I mean, if we're camping and it's chilly and we start a fire, the fire is good, right? I mean, it keeps us warm. We can cook over it. It gives light. So there's a lot of beneficial, very positive things about fire. But if we decide we're going to stick our hand in the middle of it, we're going to suffer the consequences. If we try and bring fire into our tent, we're going to set the tent on fire. So fire can go either way. It can be positive. It can be negative. It can be life-giving, or it can be death-dealing. So when Exodus 24, I believe, talks about how God is a consuming fire, and actually the same verb that's used here for him eating this fire, eating up the sacrifices and eating up Nadab and Abihu, that's the same verb that's the root of that consuming fire and eating fire. So God is a consuming fire. It can go either way. I mean, it can be fantastic. It can be the fire of God that consumes our sins, that provides us with the warmth of his love, that gives light to our path. I mean, all of these wonderful blessings of the fire of God. But this fire can also be destructive. It can burn. It can injure. It can threaten. God as a consuming fire can go either way. So what makes the difference is whether this approach to God that we have, like you said, is based upon what he himself has said he wants for us. So we approach God through Christ. We don't approach God through some sort of strange fire that we ourselves have come up with, but we approach him solely by the Holy One that he has sent to us, his Son. And only through him do we have access to the Father. If we try and come up with some sort of other access, then in the end, the fire of God will be for our destruction and not for our salvation.
Amen. And that's it, man. We're out of time. It's all
fire. Man, that went by too hurt, too fast.
I know, man. It's all fire this episode. Hey, guys, we're going to be out in North Dakota on May 19th. Yes, that is the date that I mentioned earlier, the date the book comes out. You can get that book it releases at that event, and we're going to be talking about the Psalms at that event. So if you're anywhere around North Dakota, you should come out, hang out with me and Chad and a bunch of other people. We're going to be talking about the Psalms, Christ in the Psalms, how they inform this complicated thing we call life. So it's a good time. We'd like to hang out with you. There's a big conference going on in San Diego in October, and if you want to go to that, and you should go to that, that is the big one. That is the 3-day one. That's the one that will change your entire year. You'll be living off the fellowship gas that got put in the tank for the rest of the year when you go to that thing. And if you want to get a discount, that the ticket price is $199. It includes all your meals. It's an incredible deal. And if you want an even more incredible deal, you can get that knocked down to $150 if you type in the code at checkout 40 OT. So you should do that. Hey, we'd appreciate it if you go over to iTunes as well and rate and review the podcast. That helps us out, and share it on your social media. Chad, that's it for us, man. Have a great week.
All right, you too. We'll see ya.